I'm Christopher Lydon with the performance poet Sarah Kay, the youngest, most lyrical, singingest, literally most enchanting answer to the question we've been asking, where does poetry come from these days and where is it going? Our series is Whose Words These Are, on Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude from the Watson Institute at Brown University. Sarah Kay spoke verses to her Japanese mother before she could write. Her Brooklynese father packed his own poems into her school lunch every day. She started haunting the Bowery Poetry Club in New York when she was 14, and then she bloomed on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam on her way to college. She's a senior now at Brown, a national champion, and a television favorite for her kinder, gentler variation on rap, informed by Rumi, William Carlos Williams, Billy Collins, her family life, and her fantasy. She talked with us, and she delivered her celebrated Hands piece at the Watson Institute. Sarah Kay, you're a well-known performance poet before you graduated from college. What was it that got you started? Was it a poem, a poet, an impulse, or what?
Well, I've been writing poetry since before I could actually physically write. I would dictate to my mother and make her write my poems down from age, like, 3. So poetry's been in my life forever, but the performance part didn't enter into my life until I was a freshman in high school. And the reason it did was I decided that I needed to learn how to get over my crippling stage fright and try this new form of poetry. And the way that I discovered it was because of a man named Taylor Molly, who's a very well-known spoken word poet. Mm.
Was it your idea to tell your mother poems, or was she asking you?
No, I think it was my idea. I think I decided that I had something very brilliant that I needed to be recorded for posterity, and I demanded that someone take down my dictations.
So she not only listened and said, "Oh, how wonderful, sweetie," but she wrote it down.
Yes, she did write them down. The other thing that had a big part in my poetry life is from kindergarten through fourth grade, I took my own lunch to school, and every single day my mother or my father would write me a little poem and put it in my lunchbox. So I literally had a poem in my lunch every day from kindergarten to fourth grade, and neither one of them really considers themselves poets at all. It's not what either of them do, but for some reason they decided that this was something that they were going to encourage.
And these were their own words, not famous poems.
Yeah, and they ranged from, sometimes they rhymed in a sort of Dr. Seuss-y way, sometimes they were more Shel Silverstein imaginatory pieces, and sometimes they didn't, you know, sometimes they were rather serious.
Can I ask, now that you mention them, what do they do your parents?
My father is a photographer, and my family business is a camera equipment and supply store in New York. And my mother keeps my old high school from falling into the East River unofficially. She's sort of the woman behind the work that gets everything done.
What's the school?
The United Nations International School in Manhattan.
Hmm. So place yourself by now as a college senior. Where do you see yourself in the great chain of poetry, starting with spoken word? But I'm thinking of back to the original spoken word guy, Homer.
I mean, I love poetry. I love spoken word because there's an immediacy that you don't get from the page. There's a connection to not only the words themselves, but the delivery, and hearing the author tell you exactly what parts they want you to hear, in which ways they want you to hear them, which is, I think, is particularly meaningful. And I'm sort of, you know, mumbling along, trying to figure out where I fit into the grand scheme of things.
Reggie Gibson spoke of living somewhere between page and stage. Does everything you speak have an existence on paper too?
No, actually, that's a good question. There are definitely pieces that I write that, as far as I'm concerned, are meant to live on the page. And then there are other pieces that I write that are very specifically meant to be performed And some of those never get written down. Some of them do just because I want to make sure I don't forget them. But there are a number of poems of mine that I don't think are written down anywhere.
Dying to hear your work, but give us a taste, if you will, of the poetry of any sort that inspires you, that you'd take to a desert island.
As sure. There's a poem called Epitaph by Merritt Malloy, and I found it because when I was growing up, my mother is Japanese, or of Japanese descent. She's American, and my father is Brooklynese, and because of that, I grew up in a mixed racial household, and my father is Jewish, and my mother is a lapsed Episcopalian, and I was raised somewhere in between all that. My mother hopes I'll end up a Buddhist, but I did go to temple when I was a kid, and I was bat mitzvahed, and my temple was fairly alternative and pretty funky for a little East Village temple, and they used to read poetry within the service in addition to the traditional pieces, and my rabbi read this poem, and I remember it from a very young age, and it meant a lot to me and has continued to stay with me.
Let's hear it.
So this is Epitaph by Merritt Malloy. When I die, give what's left of me away to children and old men that wait to die. And if you need to cry, cry for your brother walking the street beside you. And when you need me, put your arms around anyone and give them what you need to give to me. I want to leave you something, something better than words or sounds. Look for me in the people I've known or loved. And if you cannot give me away, at least let me live in your eyes and not on your mind. You can love me most by letting hands touch hands, by letting bodies touch bodies, and by letting go of children that need to be free. Love doesn't die, people do. So when all that's left of me is love, quite simply, give me away.
Look for me under your boot soles, Walt Whitman said.
Yeah. It's funny because I don't really associate it with anything particularly religious, even though I heard it in a religious setting. But it's just, I really enjoy the idea of giving yourself away. And I think that that has a lot to do with my attraction to spoken word. There's this wonderful, wonderful theory about live theater, which is that when television first came about and moving picture first came about, people thought, well, there goes live theater, right? Now no one ever has to leave their living room. You can just watch entertainment and no one's ever going to go see live theater ever again. But it didn't die out. And a lot of people, you know, stopped to say, well, how come we're still doing this? How come we still go to see live theater when it's so much more convenient to sit at home? And I've heard somewhere that it has to do with the fact that when you see an actor on stage performing, you're aware of the fact that that actor, you know, aware somewhere in the back of your head, you're aware that that actor is going to die at some point. They are mortal. And so what they are doing on stage is giving you a part of their lives that they will never get back again. The moment that happens in the live theater is very fleeting, and you get to experience it with that person. And I think spoken word is the same thing, almost more so, because not only are you experiencing this person's moment in their life, but they're telling you, you know, their feelings and the way they've articulated their poetry.
Sarah, do you place yourself in a spoken word community or in the larger eternal nest of poetry?
I think you would get a different answer from every poet you ask that question to. I think a lot of what spoken word poetry does is have an identity crisis about where it sits in the greater realm of poetry. And I think a lot of poets who have nothing to do with the spoken word community often don't know what to do with spoken word poetry and whether or not it counts and whether or not it's poetry at all and whether or not it's vulgar and crude or lovely and, you know, just one branch of a tree. I think that there is an impulse to write poetry, or there is an impulse to make art or an impulse to be creative. And people who share that impulse do share some sort of community, whether or not they embrace it or have anything to do with each other. But I think that that exists. And some people like to seclude themselves closer with people who express themselves the same way. So spoken word poets oftentimes like to cling to each other. And more literary poets oftentimes like to cling to each other. But I think that if you got those people in the same room, they share a very specific impulse that they can relate to.
What makes it spoken word as opposed to a poem read or spoken?
A really talented spoken word poet, I believe, performs a poem that cannot be read off the paper. Meaning that something in the way that they perform it is crucial to that piece. Whether it's what they're doing with their body, whether it's what they're doing with their voice, whether it's the way they interact with the audience. But something about that piece would not be able to be captured on page alone.
Like what?
For example, the television show HBO Deaf Poetry Jam, which was probably the most famous mainstream access to spoken word poetry. And there's a wonderful poem by a poet named Reeves who... And the poem is about a poetry slam at a school for deaf children. Mm-hmm. And half the poem is done with sign language in accompaniment with the words of the poem. And if you were to write that poem down, you would miss out on half of what's going on. Whereas when you see that performed live in front of you, the meaning is magnified and is really powerful. And to me, a really good spoken word poet writes every piece of spoken word poetry that same way, regardless of whether sign language is actually being involved. Mm. You create a piece of spoken word poetry to be performed, not to be read on the page.
Is there a range of content that goes with spoken word poetry? Or put it the other way, are there things you could not express in a spoken word performance?
No, I don't think so. I think that's one of the amazing things about the art form is that if you are clever, if you are smart, if you are talented in this, in expressing yourself, you can figure out a way to get across anything you want in this form. And you're given a whole lot of tools. And that's one of the advantages to spoken word poetry is you're given a lot more tools than someone who's only writing for the page because you have the words themselves, you have your body, you have your voice, you have sometimes a microphone even to play with, you have a live audience that you can interact with or choose not to interact with. There's so much more going on there and so many more tools on your palette.
But wait, I mean, could you do a pastoral poem as spoken word?
Absolutely, I think you can. I mean, you would have to work to figure out the most effective way to do that. But that would be an amazing spoken word piece.
There's such assertion in spoken word poetry. Could you do a poem about confusion, about fear, about shyness, about diffidence, real diffidence?
I think so. I think a lot of spoken word poetry is bad, and I think a lot of it is done poorly. And I think there are very few people who do it incredibly well, and the people who do it incredibly well are able to find vast topics to speak about. The problem is that the majority of the voices in the spoken word community are all talking about the same things, and therefore it drowns out the quiet voices that speak about them.
What are those same things?
Well, spoken word poetry came for the most part, at least in the U.S. and the more modern spoken word poetry movement, came out of urban areas, came out of a need for minority in the most broad sense of the word, but minority voices to be able to be heard. There were lots of people who felt like they were not being able to express themselves, and so spoken word poetry was a way for them to get those voices heard. And so I think there's a lot of anger that comes up in spoken word poetry. There's a lot of political influence. There's a lot of that. There's generally a left-leaning theme. There's not a whole bunch of Republican spoken word poets, although I would love to see some come into the community. You know, racial motivations come up a lot of the time. Gender, sexual, you know, I guess the same could be said of any art form. But I think specifically in spoken word, there's the tendency to get on a soapbox and listen to the sound of your own voice. And I think that the people who are able to bring variety to that are the ones that are really giving the art form its due.
What connection do you, Sarah Kay, make with ancient history, say before 1990?
Ancient history before 1990. I teach spoken word poetry to a number of different age groups. And the hardest one to teach is high school students because they hate anything that they have to learn in a classroom and is clinical and something that's not exciting and something that they don't feel like they discovered on their own. And one of the things that I try to tell them is that spoken word has been around since, you know, since human beings could string sentences together. We've had troubadours, minstrels, you know, that was spoken word. You know, it's got this new fun, jazzy, hip-hop spin to it nowadays, but it certainly is not a new art form by any means. A lot of my favorite poetry is written by poets who are long gone.
Before 1970.
Yeah. Exactly.
But what about American bards like Whitman or the bard himself, Shakespeare? Do you make those connections?
Absolutely. And I think the greatest artists in general, not just spoken word, not just poetry, the greatest artists are able to steal from everywhere, right? You know, there's a wonderful saying, which is that mediocre artists borrow, great artists steal. And I think stealing includes from painters, from poets, from writers, from everywhere. And even today, there are Whitman references in hip-hop. There are, you know, we haven't ignored or lost that past.
Give us some of your own work.
All right. Now that I've challenged, you know, now that I've brought the challenge of spoken word poems being supposed to be performed and not for the page, now I have to live up to it. This is a poem that I wrote this past summer, and it's called Astronaut. I see the moon sees me. The moon sees somebody that I don't see. God bless the moon, and God bless me, and God bless the somebody that I don't see. If I get to heaven before you do, I'll make a hole and pull you through, and I'll write your name on every star, and that way the world won't seem so far. The astronaut will not be at work today. He is called in sick. He has turned off his cell phone, his laptop, his pager, his alarm clock. There is a fat yellow cat asleep on his couch, rain against the windows, and not even the hint of coffee in the kitchen air. Everyone is in a tizzy. The engineers on the 15th floor have stopped working on their particle machine. The anti-gravity room is leaking, and even the freckled kid with glasses, who's only here to clean out the trash, is nervous, fumbles the bag, spills a banana peel and a paper cup. Nobody notices. They are too busy recalculating what this will mean for lost time. How many galaxies are we losing per second? How long until the next rocket can be launched somewhere? An electron flies off its energy cloud. A black hole has erupted. A mother has finished setting the table for dinner. A law and order marathon is starting. The astronaut is asleep. He has forgotten to turn off his watch, which ticks against his wrist like a metal pulse. He does not hear it. He dreams of coral reefs and plankton. His fingers find the pillowcase's sailing masts. He turns on his side, opens his eyes once. He thinks that scuba divers must have the most wonderful job in the world, so much water to glide through.
Give us some more.
Give you some more. All right. This one's a little bit longer. can you sing to this one? I like this one because it's that one was a little bit experimental for me this summer. I was playing around with form and what I could do with my voice. And it's funny, I started out with a horrible stage fright, just cripplingly bad. And I still have pretty awful stage fright. I still get nervous every time I perform. It hasn't really gone away, but I've gotten better at hiding it. But now I've gotten used to performing poetry, but what still catches me completely off guard and still utterly terrifies me is singing in front of people. So now that's the next goal, is to figure out how to do that as well.
Frank Sinatra never got over it.
Right,
so why
good.
Should
so,
you?
So if it's good enough for Frank Sinatra, it's good enough for me. So this one, I went to India not this past summer, but the summer before. And I was traveling around northern India with a group of students. I was working on a documentary film project. And it was an incredibly life-changing experience. And when I got back, everyone I knew kept asking, how is India, or what have you been up to, and what's been going on? And I realized how often in our lives we have incredibly important experiences and how we have such a disconnect in being able to explain them to other people. And so I wrote this piece in response to the question, what have you been up to lately? Lately, I've been living with spiders. But as roommates go, they haven't been too bad. The one in the bathroom keeps to his side of the tiles, and the one in the bedroom, he can get a little bit grabby, but for the most part, he keeps his hands to himself. I guess all those car engines and hairsprays finally caught up to us, because the sky here is so polluted it glows orange from 5 p.m. through night till morning. Some people think it's disgusting that you can wash off what you thought was a tan, but me, I can't help but fall in love with a city that has 15 hours of twilight. If I ever have a grunge rock band, I will name it Beautiful Pollution. Outside the city, the dark is so dark, it is easy to forget which day is Tuesday. But the night there was a dry lightning storm, it was like strobe lights through the window. I snuck outside and stood with my face up, smiling. I thought God was taking photographs. And even though I felt silly standing there in my underwear, I figured I needn't be embarrassed. He's seen me in a whole lot less. Some nights, I wake up with a black hole in my chest. It echoes like a beatboxing hurricane and burns like a grandmother's memory. I tried Pepsid AC. It didn't help. I gave a haircut with big sloppy scissors and even made it look kind of nice. It was mainly a courtesy cut anyway. We all knew it wouldn't do much for the lice or the bed bugs. I've been looking for my favorite constellations everywhere, but I can't find any yet. The spaces between stars are so different here, much wider. I have always relied on the English of others, and in this rickshaw named Desire, it's no exception. On a cement rooftop somewhere off the highway, it is creeping its way towards night when 19-year-old Ravi begs me to write a love letter for him. It is for Neha, the girl he is in love with. She speaks English. He does not. So he cannot explain to me that this is forbidden, that he is already set to marry whomever his parents choose, but certainly someone within the village, and certainly someone within the caste, and certainly not this someone wrapped in yellow silk smiling up at me from the photograph he shows me. I write it for him anyway. It has something about the moon, some stars in the sky, the way her eyes sparkle, and how he wishes they were together always. When I hand it back to him, he takes it from my hands and reads it carefully out loud. He does not understand a single word, but reads diligently and slowly, looking up at me every so often to see if he is pronouncing the words correctly. When I hear what I have written out loud, the cliches hang in the air between us like bad breath, and I wish that I could take it back and write it over. I would write, "Dear Neha, be careful about rooftops. Not about how high they are, but about how quickly your heart beats the faster you climb. Ravi's hands are good for climbing. I like the way he stands behind his mother while she's working, not so much to insist on helping her, but just to let her feel his presence in case she needs him to reach for something on a top shelf. I like that he believes in love letters. His pants are a few inches too short. Have you ever come to visit him here? Probably not. The peacocks are enormous. They sound like cats. No one seems to pay them very much mind, but the males dance across all the rooftops of the village, begging for somebody to notice their tails. Good luck with your secret, Sarah. Ravi gets to the end of the letter and reads the words, I love you. These are words he understands. He smiles an enormous smile and bows his head. On the way back to the car, the translator tells me that Ravi wishes to say thank you. I tell him to tell Ravi good luck, and he does so. Ravi puts both hands inside the car window and says to me, Danyabad, over and over, thanking me for the love letter. Boho, boho, Danyabad. He will never marry her, the translator tells me, after we have been on the road for a few minutes in the dark. Yes, I say, but he can love her. It is monsoon season, and I watch as tall street corners become riverbanks and potholes become death traps. Not even the rickshaws are safe. The cobra I met in the garden behind the lantern shed was much smaller than I'd imagined, but the mangoes were just as sweet. That's probably why when we cut one open, a spider crawled out. It had made its home inside. Mom, the elephants here, they all look orange. I think it's because of the henna in the soap.
Sarah, that's so gorgeous.
Thank you.
So what have you been up to lately? That's the answer. I was thinking, can I ask, the spoken word poet, can I ask, does that piece have a kind of poetic form in it? Or does it write its own form?
That specific poem or spoken word poetry in general?
Either one.
Well, I don't think there is any predetermined form necessarily to spoken word poetry. Mm. I think that's one of its best attributes and also one of its biggest dangers, for sure. I think that specific poem for me was, I knew there was a story that I needed to tell, but I knew that it wasn't just about the story. It was very much about everything else that was going on for me and what had been going on lately. So It was much more about trying to find a way to express all of the things that had been going on, which is rare for me. Usually in my poetry, it's more tied to a specific narrative. This one was a little bit more free-flowing, I think.
Sarah, what's your process?
The thing for me about spoken word is a spoken word piece is not finished until it is performed. You know, if I finish writing it at home at 3 o'clock in the morning on my laptop, that doesn't mean it's done. It's not done until it's on its feet and I figure out what needs to be changed. And a lot changes in the performance. Plenty of times I've written poetry that I think is great and brilliant, and I have a killer last line, and then I get up there and I start performing it, and I realize, oh, no, wait a second, that's not at all the way that this is supposed to go, and then it gets changed, which is one of the reasons why a lot of my work is not written down, or if it is written down, it's in various forms, because it changes so often from one performance to the next.
So it has something in common with jazz or maybe with stand-up comedy in that you're back and forth with your audience, I think.
Well, I think the best spoken word poets find a way to incorporate the audience into what they're doing. You know, we have a live audience there, which page poets don't get. So why would you perform something and ignore those other people in the room? When you incorporate them into the experience or you acknowledge that they're there, I think that's wonderful. And I think that's that an audience really appreciates that as well.
Are there poets out there that we read on the page poets you call them, that are waiting to be rediscovered as spoken word folk?
Sure. I think great poetry translates. You know, great poetry is great poetry.
Who would you like to reinvent? Exhume as a spoken word poet.
Well, honestly, I think Rumi is great off the page. I love reading it. But I also love William Carlos Williams a lot. I think I absolutely think that his work is meant to be heard out loud. There's a rhythm to it and the word choice. He's so economic about the words that he picks and the words that he uses, and he chose them for a very specific reason, because they were the right ones. And to be able to hear those words out loud, I think, is pretty great.
Dare I ask you to do the hands piece?
I wrote that poem when I was, I think, 17. And it got picked up for HBO when I was 18. And that's the performance that most people know, because that's the most mainstream access to any of my work. And for me, you asked what my process was. A big part of my process is not denying where I am right now. So when I was 17, I wrote 17-year-old poems. And now that I'm 21, I write 21-year-old poems, you know. And what that means is a lot of my poetry does have a shelf life, you know. And I think my better work, hopefully, has a little bit more staying power. But there are plenty of poems that I write that I outgrow as I get older, because
don't outgrow hands.
Right. So it's funny to me that poem has come along for the ride, I guess would be the way to say it. I turned 21 this past summer, and I gave a big performance in New York City at the Bowery Poetry Club, which is where I started and where I was given my poetry legs to stand on, and where I've been blessed with incredible mentors and incredible peers and fellow poets. And so I did a show there for my 21st birthday, and I performed Hands for probably the first time since I was 18.
I'm dying to hear a 21-year-old reading of a 17-year-old poem.
People used to tell me that I had beautiful hands. Told me so often, in fact, that one day I started to believe them, until I asked my photographer father, "Hey, Daddy, could I be a hand model?" To which he said, "No way." I don't remember the reason he gave me, and I probably would have been upset, but there were far too many stuffed animals to hold, too many crayons to grab, too many homework assignments to write, too many ponytails to tie, too many boys to wave at, too many years to grow. We used to have a game, my dad and I, about holding hands, because we held hands everywhere, on the beach, in a park, in a movie, and every time either he or I would whisper a great big number to the other, pretending that we were keeping track of how many times we had held hands, that we were sure this one had to be 8,002,753. Hands learn more than minds do. Hands learn how to hold other hands, how to grip pencils and mold poetry, how to memorize computer keys and telephone buttons in the dark, how to hold babies and touch old people. I love hands like I love people. They are the compasses with which we navigate our way through life, feeling our way over mountains past and valleys crossed. They are our histories. Some people read palms to tell your future, but I read hands to tell your past, each scar marking a story worth telling. Each calloused palm, each cracked knuckle is a missed punch or years in a factory. Now I've seen Middle Eastern hands clenched in Middle Eastern fists, pounding against each other like war drums. Each country sees their fists as warriors, and others as enemies, even if fists alone are only hands. But this is not about politics. No, hands are not about politics. This is a poem about love and fingers. Fingers interlocked like a beautiful accordion of flesh or a zipper of prayer. One time, I grabbed my dad's hand so that our fingers interlocked perfectly, but he changed position, saying, "No, that handhold is for your mom." Kids high five. Teamwork turning into camaraderie, but grown up, we learn how to shake hands. You need a firm handshake, but don't hold on for too long, but don't let go too soon, but don't hold too tight. But hands are not about politics. When did it become so complicated? I always thought it simple. The other day, my dad looked at my hands as if seeing them for the first time, and with laughter behind his eyelids, with all the seriousness a man of his humor could muster, he said, "You know, you've got nice hands. You could have been a hand model." And before the laughter can escape me, I shake my head at him and squeeze his hand. 8,002,754.
Are you ready for the Proust questionnaire?
Sure.
All-time favorite poem or poet?
Yikes.
You've been there. But just take another swing at it if you like.
Okay. I'm gonna just list people that I love.
Please.
In the page world, I love William Carlos Williams. I love Rumi. I'm a big Rumi kid. I love Wisława Szymborska. I love Adrian Rich, Billy Collins, all over the map, really. And then in the spoken word world, Taylor Molly was the first influence on my work. I love Buddy Wakefield. Reeves is a huge influence. Anis Mojgani, wonderful, wonderful poets. And Kristen O'Keefe Aftowicz is a big influence and a big inspiration to me. She is the one who created Urbana, which is the name of the team from the Bowery Poetry Club, which goes to nationals every year. And that's the team that took me to nationals when I was 18. I was the youngest person at nationals that year. Mm. And she created that, and she's an amazing woman and an amazing poet.
What talent would you most love to have that you don't yet?
I would love to have a thicker skin. I don't know if that counts as a talent. If we're going with talent, I guess I would love to be athletic, which I am utterly not. My brother is a incredible, incredible athlete, and I like to tell him that that's because I gave him all of my athletic genes, and now he gets all of them.
Who's your favorite character in all the fiction you've ever read?
Whoa. Who's your favorite character? Oh, God. Does Winnie the Pooh count?
Sure.
My favorite book, my favorite fiction, piece of fiction is 100 Years of Solitude. Mm. So I don't know if there's a specific character in that book, but as a work, that would be my favorite. I will say that that's the only book that I have memorized the first line of the book.
Let's hear it.
Now I'm on the spot. I hope I get this right. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. Mm. I believe. Hopefully I'm close.
Take a stab at one.
Yeah, let me think for a second. I think if it was going to be one fictional character, it would probably be actually not in that book at all. Hmm. If it's specifically the character, it would be Blue Avenger, which is from The Adventures of Blue Avenger, which I believe was a, you know, teen, adolescent literature book that I read when I was, you know, 14 or something. But I just remember the character being everything that I wanted to be.
Who did Blue Avenger avenge? How?
Blue Avenger was an average guy who woke up one day and decided he was going to change his name officially to Blue Avenger. And his girlfriend was named Omaha, Nebraska. And he solved problems, very simple problems, that were important to people. So someone needed to make the perfect key lime pie, I think, and he had to figure out how to do that. And he was a problem solver.
Sarah Kay, who's the artist of all time in any medium that you sort of feel a kinship with? Who's out there doing your work in another medium?
Well, I don't know if this counts, but my father is a photographer, and he and I share a love of finding the moment and trying to capture it. He does it visually. I do it with words. But that is something that I think I learned from him, was to find, you know, he says find the light, and he means it literally. But I think I take it slightly more metaphorically, professionally, or I guess, well, he's still professional, but besides him, I love Magritte. I love Rene Magritte. And I think that his work is very playful and often dark, but also he's very concrete. He uses things that I can see and recognize and feel. And that's something that I try to do very much in my own work.
You're two for two. Do you want to go for three?
Another artist.
You could say that's sort of my soul in
another art form. Sure. Yeah. There's a filmmaker named Wong Kar-wai from Hong Kong who made the film In the Mood for Love, also 2046. He's In the Mood for Love is probably the most beautiful film I've ever seen, and it's so subtle, it's so quiet, it's so not a movie my little brother would be able to sit through. not that my little brother can sit through much of my poetry either, so I guess that would be another reason why we're kindred spirits.
What would you say is the key note of your personality in your work?
I come from a pretty personal place. You know, if I'm being political, it's not broad politics. It had to come from somewhere very, very personal. There's a saying which is, write what you know. And I was taught, don't write what you know, write what you don't know and you're trying to figure out. And I would say often when I sit down to write a poem, it's because it's something I've been thinking about and I'm trying to figure it out for myself. And sometimes I get to the end of the poem and I have, and sometimes I get to the end of the poem and I have no idea still. But for that reason, it comes from a very personal place.
Name a single quality that you love in a poem, yours or anybody else's, that you look for in a poem.
Well, I love a good ending. If you have a killer last line, That's really something.
Sarah, you teach in Hope High School here in Providence, Rhode Island. What do you learn from your students?
What do I not learn from my students? they're wonderful. They are what has kept me in the spoken word world, I think, because I started a long time ago. I started when I was 14, which means I've been doing this for a while, and I've certainly been watching it for a long time. When I started, all I did was watch spoken word constantly and immerse myself in as many different poets and styles as I could. And I think there was a point at which I was almost done. I thought I was done. I thought I was bored. I thought there was nothing else to be learned. And teaching and being able to articulate to a room full of high school students who up until this point had no interest in poetry has taught me to figure out what is good and what needs work. The most wonderful thing is when one of my students writes a poem and says, oh, it's not very good or no one's going to like it, and then they perform it and somebody else comes up and says, whoa, I know exactly what you're talking about. And you can see it like brush fire. It just lights them up and they say, oh, hey, I guess other people feel the same way I do, which I think is a very, you know, universal feeling for teenagers. That's what spoken word in high school is so important.
What's your motto?
Right now, my motto is say thank you. I think my mother is very Tao, or tries to be very Tao. And every morning when she wakes up, the first thing she does is say thank you. And when she goes to sleep, she says thank you before she goes to sleep. And I really like that. I've been trying to discipline myself to do the same thing.
It's gorgeous.
Thanks.
Sarah Kay, thank you.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Sarah Kay. Our Brown University interns, Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern, introduced us to her. Thanks to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival for drawing us into the life of this art today, and thank you for listening. All the more if you'll leave a comment, or your own poem, or your favorite poem from somebody else, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon.